Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this
morning we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, chapter 16, entitled A Description of Jambudvipa, texts 16 to 19. I should just read, I guess, the verse. And,
Mandaro tsa sanga ekadasha shata yojanu tanuga devachuta shiraso girishikara stulani palani amritam kalapani patanti.
So word by word, or it's not necessary. You should do. Okay.
Mandara utsange on the lower slopes of Mandara Mountain. Ekadasha shata yojana utanga, 1,100 yojanas high. Devachuta shirasaha, from the top of a mango tree named Devachuta. Girishikara stulani, which were as fat as mountain peaks. Falani, fruit. Amrita kalpani, as sweet as nectar. Patanti, fall down. So translations and finally purport of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. On the lower slopes of Mandara Mountain is a mango tree named Devachuta. It is 1,100 yojanas high. Mangoes as big as mountain peaks and as sweet as nectar fall from the top of this tree for the enjoyment of the denizens of heaven. That's a short purport. It states that in the Vayupurana there is also a reference to this tree by great learned sages. It's text 17. When all those solid fruits fall from such a height, they break and the sweet fragrant juice within them flows out and becomes increasingly more fragrant as it mixes with the other scents. That juice cascades from the mountain in waterfalls and becomes a river called Arunoda, which flows pleasantly through the eastern side of Ilavrita. Text 18. The pious wives of the Yakshas act as personal maidservants to assist Bhavani, the wife of Lord Shiva. Because they drink the water of the river Arunoda, their bodies become fragrant, and as the air carries away that fragrance, it perfumes the entire atmosphere for the 80 miles around. Text 19. Similarly, the fruits of the jambu tree, which are full of pulp and have very small seeds, fall from a great height and break to pieces. Those fruits are the size of the elephants, and the juice gliding from there becomes a river named Jambu Nadi. This river falls a distance of 10,000 yojanas from the summit of Meru Mandara to the southern side of Ilavrita and floods the entire land of Ilavrita with juice. Purport. We can only imagine how much juice there might be in a fruit that is the size of an elephant but has a very tiny seed. Naturally, the juice from the broken jambu fruits forms waterfalls and floods the entire land of Ilavrita. That juice produces an immense quantity of gold, as it will be explained in the next verses. Om Gyanati Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yenat Asmai Shri Gurave Namaha
Namo Vishnu Praya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shimateya Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namini Namasteya Sarasvati Deva Gauravani Pracharne Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Adishitadini Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So here we have very interesting description of a Ilavrita Varsha, which is on the Jambudvipa island. And this description, it may seem like something very fascinating, and it is definitely, but it may also be a little bit kind of a challenging description for someone who only essentially accepts something very empirical as some kind of an evidence, as we find nowadays that is basically a notion in modern scientific circles, that essentially only things that we can perceive can be accepted as true or real. So to hear that there are some enormous fruits that produce large quantities of juice, and that it is something that is very produces some fragrance in a person who eat that particular juice, and that it actually floods the entire land, is something practically to us inconceivable. Because as we have been trained, essentially, through the educational circles, modern educational circles, we accept only those things which we can perceive. We believe only those things which we can perceive. So this seems like a very, very unacceptable kind of explanation, something that people would say it's not scientific, that we shouldn't take it so seriously, that we shouldn't take it literally, that we should just maybe accept it as some kind of a story, some kind of an allegory. But Srila Prabhupada was very much staunch in his presentation, and he would never accept such kind of idea that we shouldn't take anything literally. Srila Prabhupada said that whatever have been stated in the scriptures, it's all literal. And it's all historical, it's not some kind of mythology. Like when people would interpret Srimad Bhagavad Gita and say that, for example, Kurukshetra means the body and Pandava senses and so on. Srila Prabhupada said, no, Kurukshetra is the real place. There is a railway station, there is still the land there and where the battle was fought. So he would never agree to such kind of proposals, such kind of misinterpretations. So there is that description here that we find that essentially materialistic people cannot accept, as I said, as literal. But as we found, as we find actually in Srila Prabhupada's teachings, he was also very much eager to present this kind of reality that we cannot perceive. We know that Krishna's mission is to actually shatter all the materialistic conceptions, shatter all the conceptions of all the atheistic personalities who can't accept or don't want to accept such kind of, for example, information. Like, for example, Lord Nisimhadev. He appeared to Hiranyakashipu, who just couldn't conceive God in such kind of a form. Hiranyakashipu made all different kinds of requests to Lord Brahma, that he didn't want to be killed in any particular way, by any particular person, by any particular weapon. And this is what empiricists try to do. They just think that they themselves are kind of supreme, and they can figure out the ways and means to become immortal and supreme. Anyway, so but then Lord Nisimhadev appears and completely shatters all their conceptions, materialistic conceptions, because we know the spiritual life is beyond sense perception. It's beyond pratyaksha. It's beyond whatever we can perceive. We are so limited. We are so insignificant. And therefore, to completely destroy such kind of conception, which is imperfect anyway, and it has four defects, Krishna therefore presents us something that is beyond such kind of limitations. And that knowledge, that information comes from the acharyas, who are realized souls. Tadvidi pranipatena pariprashina seva upadekshantite gyanam gyanam statva darshinaha. That means from those persons who are darshina, who had the vision, who had the realization. It doesn't mean just some kind of dry theoretical knowledge. No, it's something that has been realized.
Or the information comes from the Shastra, which is perfect anyway, because we know Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic scriptures are apaurusheya, that means perfect. So there is no any flaw in such kind of descriptions. So this kind of information, then, when we receive, we understand it's perfect information. And we shouldn't definitely speculate about it or think that it's maybe some kind of interpretation. Srila Prabhupada said that interpretation is only required where things are not so clear, actually. But when things are clear, he said, like when you're on the daylight, when there is a sun, there is no need of any torchlight to go around. It's so clear. There's no need for any interpretation. What to speak of any misinterpretation? That actually such kind of people who rely on sense perception itself are very prone to do. So therefore, how do we then gain the faith, essentially, such kind of descriptions? It's not so easy unless we take up to the process through which we can have realizations ourselves. So therefore, this process of bhakti yoga, we understand is the highest process, and it is the process, as Krishna mentions in 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, pratyaksha vagama mam raja vidya raja guyam pavitram idam uttamam pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam susukam kartum avyayam. It's something that we can have. Yes, it's the highest knowledge, the king of all knowledge. It's very secret. But it's also something that pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam, that means it's something that we can experience personally. It's something that essentially we can have understanding. Of course, it brings the highest happiness at the end if we practice such kind of process. But through pratyaksha, also our own pratyaksha, sense perception, we can have that kind of realization. But that realization also comes definitely through the strong practice. So this is how we develop faith. So essentially, if anybody would kind of read something like this, he would have to accept it just on the basis of faith, not on the basis of some realization initially. But if the person starts practicing the process and he understands that that process is a bona fide process and that this process works, then his faith will increase. We know sadhu sang sad no shra, how is that sadhu sangha shraddha adau shraddha sadhu sangha, yeah, that's essentially nectar of devotion. That this is the process, this is the way how we advance, this is our tool, this is our kind of a formula through which we measure our advancement in spiritual life. So this is our process. We can measure our advancement in spiritual life. So we can see how much we evolve in our faith in devotional process. Faith is always there. It's not that faith is just there in the beginning and then later on it's gone. No, it's always there. It's always kind of inherited. It's kind of essential part of the process of bhakti yoga. But it just keeps on increasing. Keeps on increasing, Krishna. So when we hear such kind of description, it actually helps us to understand that these descriptions are not just some kind of imaginary description that can maybe serve as some kind of attracting information for somebody who might have little faith and might kind of think that this is something that is part of the Karmakanda section of the Vedas and it will serve just to kind of attract the person to do some kind of ritual in some kind of spiritual life. Because when we, again, kind of hear all these different kinds of descriptions, who wouldn't like to have such kind of a fruit, for example? When we make our prasadam or something, you have just one fruit and the whole juice is done immediately. And that juice, when you use that particular substance, that it makes your body fragrant, that the fragrance can spread 80 miles around. Who wouldn't have liked to have such a juice, or who wouldn't like to taste such kind of a juice or have such kind of a fruit? So it's something that it's very attractive, and all these different descriptions that we hear here from describing the Jambudvip essentially are there also to in some way might attract someone's minds to go to such kind of a place. So this is something that Karmakanda actually section deals with. All the heavenly descriptions are actually meant for that kind of a purpose. But here that is not the case, because we know that Srimad Bhagavatam is the different kind of fruit, is galito phalam. It's a ripened fruit of the Vedic knowledge. That kind of fruit is not mixed with any kind of jnana and any kind of karma, what to speak of karma kanda. It's not mixed. It's there to serve us. It serves the purpose actually to give us the understanding of this material universe. Of course, in all the Puranas, this particular description of geography of the universe is given, or particular places. This is one of the 10 subjects that is there. But it doesn't serve that purpose to entice someone's imagination or desires to essentially go to such kind of place just for the sake of enjoyment. That's not what this is meant for. This description which is given here of this particular Jambudvi place is meant for us to understand how, first of all, we are so insignificant. Where is our position here on Jambudvip in this universe? And how this universe is enormous. It's actually such a vast place, which is meant, of course, to fulfill desires of different kinds of living entities. But the main point is that is to distinguish us from this matter. Because real knowledge is, we know, to understand what is matter, what is spirit, and who is controller of both. So these kind of descriptions serve the purpose to understand what that matter is and how we are different from it. That we don't, first of all, because our body is also kind of a universe. It's a small universe. Yogis also, when they meditate through different and elevate their energy through different chakras, these chakras represent different kinds of levels of the universe, different planetary, 14 different planetary systems. And they elevate their consciousness, and finally through Brahmaranda chakra, they kind of release their soul. So in a similar way, person is supposed to elevate their consciousness to the consciousness which is present there on those different planetary systems, 14 different planetary systems, 7 higher, 7 lower. So the person is supposed to elevate himself through this universe as well, and ultimately leave this universe and go to the spiritual abode, which is beyond this material creation. So this is what these descriptions are meant for here in Srimad Bhagavatam, to give us understanding that matter is different from spirit, and that we are not just meant to dwell on such kind of attractive features of material creation, but that we are supposed to elevate our consciousness and finally leave this material universe and not be attached to it, not being attached to those kind of places, not being attached to either our body. Because those are really interesting places. According to these descriptions, they are definitely attractive. They seem very attractive. But the main purpose is to transcend this idea of having anything to do, any kind of attachment to those kind of places, either to our body, which is matter itself. So Srila Prabhupada very much stressed to have the understanding, and this is why this description is here in Srimad Bhagavatam. This description, we know, we have to understand what the universe is. It's one of the basic 5 subjects of Bhagavad Gita, the understanding of what is the nature. So what is the nature? What is this material universe all about? So we have to understand what it is. So Srila Prabhupada very much stressed, he wanted us to have this kind of knowledge. And he said, he instructed devotees to prepare a universal model of that of the whole cosmic structure. And this is something that now it's at present happening in Mayapur. There is a team of devotees who works on the construction of the model of the universe, which presents actually the whole geographical structure of the universe and the all different planetary systems. And this will serve the purpose which Srila Prabhupada actually very much wanted, to explain in a scientific way, only from the Vedic scriptures, all the natural phenomena, essentially the 4 of them, which are the most important ones. And this is the day and night, seasons, eclipses of the moon, and the moon's phases. Because this is something, if anybody would kind of challenge the Vedic scripture, because as I said in the beginning, it seems something kind of mythological. And this is how it has been kind of accepted earlier by the early Indologists and later on propagated, and unfortunately many people have such kind of conception of Vedic scriptures. But therefore Srila Prabhupada wanted to present this particular knowledge in a scientific way, but from the Vedic scriptures itself. And we know that in the Puranas, those kind of descriptions are giving us not just such kind of only stories that are behind those scientific descriptions, but they give us some substantial understanding how essentially this universe is functioning. So through the Puranic information and through the information from the Siddhantas, which are more kind of technical texts, which are dealing with those technicalities, essentially how the sun revolves, orbits of the planets, their sizes, differences, distances from the planet, and how they influence our planet itself. These are given in the Siddhantas. So those are a little more technical. And Puranas are mostly describing, of course, some Siddhantas are contained in the Puranas. Anyway, it's a little more technical. But that description is there, so we can now plot, we can have the whole model that Srila Prabhupada wanted, that initially a lot of devotees were struggling to actually present to Srila Prabhupada and to the devotional community. So when we will have such kind of a model, definitely there is no person who wouldn't be impressed and understand that everything essentially is given in the Vedas, because Veda means knowledge. It contains all kind of information. So as well it contains information about our universe. Everybody has, at some point, had been wondering, you know, what is this universe all about? It's just natural for everybody, for anyone. So similarly, now, if we, within several few years, if we come up with this temple of the Vedic planetarium, and we present the model of the whole universe and this particular structure, which presents how, through the Vedic knowledge, we can explain all the natural phenomena, then there is no reason that people wouldn't be impressed and accept this as a science, because Srila Prabhupada said this movement is not just a religion, it's a science. Because as we said, it's science because it can prove whatever information has been stated here. We can get the proof for any information that has been stated here. So therefore here we have the description of the Jambudvipa. And Jambudvipa is the central island on the plateau of Bhumandala, which is maybe, if you can understand, it's like a chapati maybe. It's like round and very flat, and it's in the middle of the universe. So there are seven different islands and seven different oceans, and in the middle of those it's Jambudvipa. And here this Jambudvipa had been described. And this Jambudvipa, essentially, it has nine different lands or continents. Actually, they're lands. It's divided in different lands, and it has in the middle, because the whole universe is like, especially this Bhumandala, which has been described here, is like a lotus flower. And this Jambudvipa is like a whirl of a lotus, and it has its pericarp in the middle, and that is Mount Meru, surrounded by 20 different Kesara, they're called Kesara mountains, and supported by different other four little larger mountains, 10,000 yojanas high. That's a little technical, this little description, but I hope you can follow. And Mount Meru itself, it's 84,000 yojanas in height. So it's huge, huge mountain, golden mountain. That's another kind of interesting thing maybe somebody would find. There are four supporting mountains, because Mount Meru is like kind of like a cone. It's wide at the top and it's very narrow at the bottom. So different four mountains at the bottom are supporting it along with those 20 Kesara mountains. So these are prominent mountains because everything, you know, we may wonder why all these names are also mentioned, all different kinds of, it's all related to Krishna. It's all very purifying. This is why it has been stated here in Srimad Bhagavatam. So there are Kumuda, Suparshva, Mandara, Meru Mandara, these different mountains are supporting there. And then around this, it's here, what we hear is this Ilavrita Varsha. This Ilavrita Varsha, which has been described here. So sometimes it's described as a circular one, and it's just in the middle around this Mount Meru, just surrounding the Meru. But sometimes mostly it's kind of a square-like. And there are different other Varshas, Bhadrashva, Ketumala, then there is Hiranya, Ramyaka, and Kuru. On the north and on the south, there is Kimpurusha, there is Harivarsha, and our Bharatvarsha. So there are different varshas surrounding. And there are different sources. There are actually two stories describing the source describing the name, how the name of Ilavrita Varsha came to exist. One of them is what you must have probably heard, is there in the beginning of this fifth canto, second chapter, story of Maharaj Agindra, which was the son of Priyavrata Maharaj, and he had been a He had been the ruler of basically the whole universe, and then through the mercy of Lord Brahma, he understood that they have to essentially to rule and to have the whole universe keep on going and to have somebody who is going to continue the dynasty. Then Lord Brahma sent the Apsara Purvachiti, and then with Apsara Purvachiti, Angindra had 9 sons, and these are 9 sons. They got these particular lands, and by their names, those lands are named. So that means Ramyaka, Kuru, Harivarsha, and of course one of them was Ilavrita. So that is one understanding how this Ilavrita got its particular name. But another story is also because, like, one of the sons was son, his name was Nabi, and Bharatvarsha was named at that particular point as Nabi Varsha. Because we understand whoever is the ruler of particular planet or a country, that planet is named after him. So later on, there is that another story which is described in various Puranas like Linga, Matsya, and Padma. There is the story of Ila. Ila, who was a son of Vaivasvatamanu. So Vaivasvatamanu, he was ruling from Ayodhya. And, you know, the whole story after the flood and the whole population later was had expanded. So he had 10 sons, and one of them, the eldest one, was named Ila. Through him, this particular Lavrita Varsha had been also named. And another son, which was very prominent, we find his name in Bhagavad Gita, 4th chapter, 1st verse. His name was Ikshvaku. So he was also a very prominent son. And it's interesting that through Ikshvaku, then the solar dynasty was continued, and through Ila, the lunar dynasty. You know, solar dynasty later on, Lord Ramachandra appeared, and through lunar, Vrishnis and Krishna. So Ila, there is an interesting story in those Puranas. It says that Ila was once set out to conquer the all the lands, like as we hear from Mahabharata, that there is a special, very, very qualified horse sent out to different regions, and whichever king of that particular country wouldn't accept the horse, which would represent actually that particular kind of like an emperor or the ruler, essential, the topmost ruler of all the lands, then he would kind of grab that horse and tie him, and he would challenge that particular king to a fight, not accepting his position of an emperor. So Pandavas were also, before preparing for a Rajasuya sacrifice, Pandavas also set out such a horse, and different horses actually, because we know that they went in different direction. Arjuna went different direction, Bhima, Nakula and Sahadev, Yudhishthira Maharaj. They all went into different directions, Bhima, yeah. They all went into different directions following such kind of a horse. And wherever that horse would be obstructed to go through any particular land, that they would declare war, and they would go with an army, and they would fight, and they would conquer in the name of the emperor, in that case in Mahabharata, which would be Maharaj Yudhishthir. So in the similar way, Ila, because it was the eldest son of Manu, Vaivasvata Manu, who later retired onto, I guess it was described, it is Mahendravana, that means he retired from the position of the king, and he into secluded place just for sake of spiritual life and meditation. So then he entrusted this particular reign over to Ila, and as Ila was passing through different various kinds of countries, he came into Ilavrita Varsha, where Lord Shiva was associating with Bhavani and having his own pastimes there. But Lord Shiva made such an arrangement that whoever would come into the region of 10,000 yojanas within that particular place where he was enjoying with Bhavani, he would have been transferred into the woman. So no male person was allowed into that particular region. So Ila was following his horse, and then his horse turned into the mare, and Ila was transferred into the woman. And he was very shocked. He just couldn't understand. His body was transformed, and it is described that he was very, very beautiful, very attractive in different ways, and all description was given. But then Ila was completely stunned. He just was completely shocked that actually he lost also his memory practically. And he was roaming around and just wandering here and there. And then the Buddha noticed, the Buddha, not the Buddha as one of the avatars, but the Buddha, he's the son of the moon, of Chandra. So he noticed Eli and he became very attracted. And then Buddha somehow or other devised the plan. He assumed the guise of a brahmachari with the staff and the earrings, and he was inquiring from Ila, how come you're wandering? It was dusk. Said, this is it's not a proper time to wander around. Anyway, so all these kind of questions, who you are, what are you doing here, what's your background? And Buddha was very attracted to her. And then after responding, then Ila questioned him, because he was also very learned, attractive, and knowledgeable. And Buddha presented himself, I'm Buddha, I'm the son of the most learned and the leader of all the brahmanas, that is Chandra. And Buddha itself means the learned scholar. So Ila was also attracted to him. So therefore, anyway, after all, then they had the son who was Pururava. And Pururava, we know, it's a very famous story, Pururava and Urvashi, in 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So from that dynasty, then the whole moon dynasty was continued. But then the other brothers, like Ikshvaku of the Manu, then they set out in a search for Ila. They were wondering, where is Ila? What happened to him? Because he was out to conquer, and they thought maybe somebody might have fought and killed him or something. So they set out. And essentially, they asked their priest, which was Vashishta, and Vashishta, through his divine vision, his powers, could understand actually what happened. And he did, and he told them that actually Ila was transferred. And that particular Chandra Prabha horse, which was a very special horse, they were all transferred into the female forms. So they were all searching for them, and Ila, in spite of being attracted by Buddha and living in his incredibly beautiful and attractive house, has completely forgot about its real origin. So then the brothers came and they found Ila, but then they were wondering how to again make her regain its original form. So then Vashishta said that because all happened because of the influence of Lord Shiva actually and his particular arrangement, so that they have to worship Lord Shiva. And then they came across Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva told them that Ikshvaku had to perform Ashwamedha sacrifice. And if he does that, then the Ila will be transferred. But not again into its original form, because it can, according to his own arrangement, it couldn't have happened. But Ila would kind of assume a different kind of form, Kimpurusha form. Kimpurusha means kind of, literally in Sanskrit, what a man. What kind of man? Some kind of strange kind of appearance. But it's a man. They're different. We know 400,000 different kind of species of human bodies are there. So anyway, Kimpurusha is such kind of... It's said that Hanuman also resides in this Kimpurusha at present. Kimpurusha Varsha and worships Lord Hanuman. I'm sorry, Ramachandra. So then Ila was transferred to that Kimpurusha, but then Lord Shiva said that actually it can be done completely. So it was like 1 month Ila was in a male form as a Kimpurusha, and another month he spent the rest of his existence in a female form. So it was changing the forms essentially. But this is a story about Ilavrita Varsha. So there are these two different sources that we can understand. The different Varshas in this Jambudvip region are named according to a particular ruler of that particular land. So here is also another interesting thing this change of the form. Somebody may also wonder, it's something kind of like a mystical, and we know that some people also like to change the form. I just heard from devotees, some people do it kind of several times at the place where I'm just heading, Amsterdam. And you know, it's like kind of all different kind of desires people have to experience this material world. But this is something that origins essentially from the Lord Shiva, because of course there's some perverted desires like this which still don't give satisfaction and happiness to anyone ultimately. But once when Lord Brahma was trying to inspire all of his sons to populate the universe, then he also requested Lord Shiva to do so. But then Lord Shiva, being mostly associated with the mode of ignorance, then he started creating different kinds of beings, and those were like ghostly mostly beings and hobgoblins. But they had such kind of desires, and they started chasing Lord Shiva. And then Lord Shiva had to run somehow or other, saved himself. And then Lord Brahma somehow or other prevented them from chasing Lord Shiva, and ultimately they had a desire to kill Lord Shiva, who was his creator, who was their creator anyway. So then Lord Brahma requested him. He said, "My dear Lord Shiva, don't create anymore. You better do something else. We'll assign some other task for you." He said, "Maybe you should be in charge for destruction, but don't create anymore." So this is essentially the origin of such kind of perverted desires. And we see that anyway in different scriptures, like Mahabharata, there are also different kinds of, I mean, people have that particular desire maybe to experience different kinds of bodies, different kinds of forms. So that's not unusual, because those desires are, as we said, in different kinds of modes. But of course we know some artificially or whatever way it may be, it doesn't actually lead to any satisfaction. It just creates further and further bondage here, in this material world, and creates further simple problem. I mean, activities and problems, whatever. So, interesting description is there in the case of Amba. Amba was one of the three wives that Bhima tried to secure for to continue the Kuru dynasty, and she definitely was angry at Bhishma, because Bhishma didn't want to accept her. Bhishma had a vow to remain celibate throughout his whole life, and Amba wasn't accepted by Shishupal, who essentially wanted to marry her. So because she was already touched, Shishupal rejected her. So Amba was very desperate, and then she was so angry at Bhishma that she decided to kill him. But because she was a woman, she wasn't able to do so. So she performed severe austerities. And to make the story short, essentially, Lord Shiva blessed her that she will appear in the next life as a Shikhandi, as a woman again, but she will somehow or other had her form transformed into the male, and this form will be, and in that form she'll be able to kill Bhishma. So her form was also kind of a transfer, all different, a little bit subject again, but it's something that is related to this transformation of Ila, because again, as we said, some people may wonder how all these things happen and why. But so Shikhandi appeared as in a female form, but then Drupad got the information from Lord Shiva himself saying that after some time Shikhandi will regain actually his male form, or will be granted the male form. And already Drupad Maharaj was arranging for the marriage, and he particular kingdom from he found some beautiful princess. But then that king found out that actually the Shikhandi is a woman, so how can woman get married to woman? And she got very enraged, and he sent a whole army to Drupad's kingdom. And now Drupad was all in anxiety, what to do now, because Shikhandi was still a female. But then, being so depressed, and Shikhandi went to the forest and somehow or other came across one yaksha and narrated the whole background, whole story about it. And then yaksha, being compassionate, he had the power, like here, because here the yakshas are mentioned. Yakshas are very special beings. Yakshas are, to us, they might be invisible. They can be visible if they want so. But essentially, they're more subtle. All the bodies here described on this particular, like that are here, all these different upadevatas that are here, they have more subtle bodies, they have more beautiful bodies, they have more larger bodies. Like we hear about this particular fruit, it's so large. There's nothing strange about the larger fruit, because people were also large. In Skanda Purana, there is information that people were, in Satya Yuga, they were 5 talas tall. Tala means palm trees. So if you put 5 palm trees, that means that was the height of a person in Satya Yuga. And this Jambudvipa described here, Jambudvipa essentially, on Jambudvipa, there is always Treta Yuga. That means duration of life, it's 10,000 years and people are 3 talas high in height. That means 3 palm trees in height. So maybe there is no wonder that such kind of huge fruits are there also. Or maybe when we wonder like pyramids or some huge structures that we found in South America or something, they're huge, but people were also huge. Maybe that somebody may be disappointed that diminishes its glory or something. But people were huge, so there is no wonder that there were huge structures sometimes in the past as well. Anyway, so these yakshas are very special beings. They're described also in Indraprastha when Pandavas had their own palace built. They could perform various kinds of menial services. Sometimes if there would be a gap, kind of like some kind of a gap between the space, and you would think that you can't cross on the other side, and yakshas, because just understanding your desires, they could read the mind, they would manifest some kind of a steps or some kind of a bridge that you could cross. And this is why Duryodhana was so bewildered. When Duryodhana came to Indraprastha Palace, there were so many things happening, he just couldn't understand what's going on, whether it's a land, whether it's a water, what's going on. But just there were those yakshas who were serving there, and they would just, by thought, they would manifest different kinds of things, make things happen. So these yakshas are special beings here, and they were all here. These were here, it is described that they're all, these were female kind of maid servants of the Bhavani. They were assisting Bhavani. So they had also, they were specially empowered to assist Durga or Bhavani here. So coming back to the story, that was that special kind of empowered yaksha who could transfer his manliness to Shikhandi. And this is what happened. And then when Shikhandi came back, of course, then the marriage was arranged and different. There was one party sent to ensure that Shikhandi is a male, and then when that was done, somehow or other at the last moment, then the other king agreed for the marriage and Shikhandi was married. But then the deal was that as soon as this is done, that his, again, that form would have been transferred back to that yaksha. But Kuvera, who is the lord of yakshas, and Kuvera is very closely, we understand that yakshas are associating with Bhavani because Lord Kuvera, who is the lord of yakshas, is a very close friend to Lord Shiva. So when Kuvera found that out, he became very angry and he cursed that yaksha. That actually, now you will remain in that particular form. He was very angry because the yaksha was supposed to perform one particular task anyway. So when Shikhandi came back, then yaksha explained that this is what happened, and then Shikhandi felt very bad about it. So then finally yaksha requested Kuvera to somehow or other relieve him from that curse, but Kuvera didn't, as usually when curse once is pronounced, it's very difficult to make it the other way around. So then he said, when Shikhandi leaves the body, then your manliness will be restored. So this is what happened after Shikhandi, when he was killed on the Kurukshetra battle, then that yaksha again regained his original form. So this is what we find here in all these different kinds of, we may say, from empirical point of view, as we mentioned in the beginning, these are all kind of, somebody will say just some kind of mythological stories or mythological descriptions. But as I said, if we are sincere to follow this particular process and this particular age that has been given to us, we will gain faith. We will have understanding that it's not just some kind of mythological story, it's not some kind of imaginary description, but that is something either historical or either scientific. That is something very substantial that we can experience also ourselves, of course, if we become qualified for it. So I would stop here if there is any question or comment. Hare Krishna.
So that is the first step, actually, to convince people on the empirical basis. Because Siddhanta's information, which is given in the Siddhantas, is not different. Maybe there are some little differences with the modern understanding, modern astronomical understanding. So empirically, essentially, it's almost identical. It's actually even more precise. This information we got from, there is one person, Balachandra Rao, he's a professor and he's associated with the Indian Space Research Center, and he's very good mathematician. He has so many this different kinds of qualifications, and he wrote many books. He's very, very renowned in the Indian scientific community, especially this astronomical scientific community, and he goes to different conferences. Anyway, he has a lot of credentials. So he said that actually there are some formulas in the Siddhantas that are far more precise to determine particular planetary positions and different kinds of things than those which now in the modern astronomical fields the modern scientists are using. So on the empirical basis, this is that first step, that first people will be, of course, initially, when somebody sees the universe, this is just like some kind of presentation for the layman. It's not really just for those who are more scientifically minded and those who want to go deeper. And therefore, if somebody wants to go deeper, then there is some of those literatures which will be presented. Then here it is, you can study yourself. So there will be that educational also second step, so to say, for those who are really interested to go deeper. So this is maybe just initially to somehow or other attract people, because everybody wants to see what is the universe all about, and maybe they like to see like some different demigods or some... From whichever reason, it will be impressive. But then those who want to go deeper and those who might be a little challenging, then we have an answer for them. That's the point. So this is what then devotees will serve to, basically somehow or other guide people towards that understanding. Maybe they won't get that initially from seeing the whole model, but maybe those who are a little more curious, who might question, then that's what devotees are for, to be there, to preach about it. So. I don't know what they're planning something, but practically, really, I don't know yet. The idea, it's mostly to present through dioramas and through some information, and somehow rather than to point out to someone who has the knowledge, or through some literature, or to someone. Definitely, that's not excluded. That is definitely part of the whole presentation, because it won't, as you said, it won't have much sense if there isn't that second step. Somebody who is going to explain everything, somebody who may guide further. So, but how and when this is going to be done, I don't know. Yeah, there are very few. Because it initially it's just inconceivable. Maybe like when anybody reads this fifth canto, it's just difficult to understand at all. But this is why, again, like I know Dhanavir Maharaj, for example, and even I'm not sure Advindra Svarupa, but I think he also had in Mayapur presentations on the Vedic cosmology. So through, again, that kind of education through some seminars, devotees will be more informed about. It's a little more technical. This is I was also trying today not to be too technical or something, but it takes some more time. It has to, you know, like sink down. It has to settle. It has to go over and over. And it's not easy just from hearing to understand this type of information. This is why you need a model. You need something to see also, to see three-dimensionally at least how it functions. Although all the universe is not just three-dimensional, it's multidimensional also, and how to fit and understand everything is not so easy. Yeah, I don't know what to do. Because at least through Vedic model, things don't change. It's eternalist. And modern view is always changing. So that's the advantage, actually, of the Vedic. Yeah, but they always have different kinds of theories that are replacing another one. So, but we have a same model from now till eternity and since past, so that's the advantage, yes. Yeah, Surya Siddhanta is given by Maya Dhanava. But they're one of the six they're part of Vedangas, that means additional Vedic literatures. Siddhantas. Jyotisha. Yes. So
won't be in its completeness, but at least to have some idea about it. It's impossible, because as we said, Lord Brahma even said in Srimad Bhagavatam, in that verse, that he himself cannot understand this material creation. It's so inconceivable, incompleteness. It's so amazing, it's so wonderful. We can't anyway, because we are so limited. We are just can perceive three dimensions and we have imperfect senses. So how much we can understand anyway? So at least to degree that we can, at least that much it should be inspiring for us to pursue further, you know, and accept all the other informations about from this Shastra. Thank you all very much, Lord Prabhupada. Ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam, ki jai.